Well, the calendar still says April, but the eastern half of the country today was in the grip of a record heat wave. This while much of the Midwest was reeling from thunderstorms and tornadoes.
Climate science has predicted it. As the energy level of the atmosphere is rising, the variability, weather variability, occurrence of extreme weather events also increases. And you can get out of extreme heat and dry, you can get extreme floods, and you can get cyclones, and that's been happening, I'm afraid, yes.
Temperatures rose into the low 90s and records tumble. In some parts of the east, 25 degrees above average.
It was not a bushfire. These were firestorms. There's a difference. In a firestorm, the oxygen burns in the atmosphere above the bush. There is no way of stopping it. The air temperatures rise to just everything gets incinerated in the path of these fireballs.
Temperature melts the ice and snow. Time to wait. Won't be long and it'll be too late. In this together and we're all at stake. Cause where we gonna go, I don't know.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Are we heading towards a climate catastrophe? I'm Alex Smith with a special guest from Australia. Dr. Andrew Glickson is a visiting fellow at the Department of Earth and Marine Science and the Planetary Science Institute at the Australian National University. He has been studying the history of rocks and life for over 40 years. Dr. Glickson specializes in visitors from outer space and no, not the alien life forms, but comets and asteroids colliding with our planet. Some of these impacts may have had massive changes in the Earth's climate, followed by mass extinction, so there's a lot we can learn here. Dr. Glickson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, we picture academics surrounded by books in their offices, but you've spent long periods clambering over rocks in some of the most remote parts of Australia. What do these rocks tell us about the relationship between living things and these accidents from outer space?
Yes, most of the rocks I have been studying in the early days were formed almost 3 billion years and more in the history of the Earth. It's only later that I started looking at the younger rocks and the younger events of mass extinction in connection with asteroid impacts, comets, and volcanic eruptions. This field is one that I moved into about 15 or 20 years ago, and which I'm looking at now at the Australian National University. It's a fascinating field, the way that natural cycles recreate themselves. That's the way the world works. And with major impacts by asteroids and volcanic periods, which result in extinction of anywhere, the largest one is almost 90-95%, 250 million years ago. So from point of view of nature, these events, you can't say they're good or bad. It's just the way nature works through or renews itself. It is about 10 years ago that it became clear, or perhaps even before then, that we are living through a mass extinction event, but that this one is of a different nature.
Well, it seems odd, I think, that we know a lot about World War II, perhaps, but few people understand the biggest events in our planet's history. I'm wondering if you could take a little bit of time and describe some of these past major extinctions and what may have caused them.
Yes. Well, the five major ones, every one of them that we know about was related to the impact by asteroids, but also to volcanic events at about the same time. And that's curious because you would be looking for a cause and effect. It's possible, in my view even likely, that some of these very major impacts by asteroids, which were, 10 kilometer in size and would have caused created craters which are almost 200 kilometer in diameter, also triggered volcanic activity. That's a bit difficult to prove, even though there is an overlap in ages. The error is still there. But the combination of these events rather the response of the Earth was to release billions of tons of dust and of aerosols, sulfur dioxide, and of carbon dioxide and methane, a whole concoction which for a period changed the composition of the atmosphere. And this is documented by quite a number of studies. One of the great experts is Peter Ward, who has written a famous book, Under a Green Sky. Under a Green Sky, yeah. That's about the Permian-Triassic, that's 250 million years ago. But also another closer to the present is an event called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal event of thermal maximum called PETM 55 million years ago, in which we know that, due to the eruption of methane from the seafloor, which is connected with volcanic activity, but 2,000 gigatons, that's a billion tons of carbon, have been released, even though not instantaneously, it must have taken some time. And its temperature has risen by several degrees, and a mass extinction has occurred. Not as major as some of the other. This is the closest to what we're looking at now, because humans have emitted 300 gigatons carbon plus released, plus cleared large land surfaces. So if they continue, with all the feedbacks, which is a main worry, the feedbacks from the biosphere and the warming oceans, something is happening. An even closer event is 3 million years ago. That's really close because the continent ocean configuration pattern was similar to the present. That's in the mid Pliocene. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere rose to 400 parts per million, which is very much where we are now. We are even higher now if you include methane. We are at 440 parts per million equivalent. And at that stage, we don't know about a mass extinction. There were some extinctions, but humans were already there, let's say 1 million years ago. What happened was, at that stage, the mid-Pliocene, temperatures rose by about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, which is similar to the IPCC projections for the next, for this coming century. And sea level rose by about 25 meters with an arrow of plus minus 12 meters. But we know that Florida was flooded and a lot of other coastal areas. We don't know about major eruption of methane at that time, but otherwise the mid-Pliocene is it's really two drops of water close to what's happening now. And for this reason, the United States Geological Survey studied this period in great detail.
Well, lately you've been warning that with human-induced climate change, mammals may not survive. Isn't that a bit extreme?
It's certainly extreme. It's certainly extreme, but only tiny mammals or small mammals, burrowing mammals, could exist before the Cenozoic, before 65 million years ago, during the greenhouse phase, the Cretaceous greenhouse phase at which the Earth existed, and dinosaurs and the other creatures were perfectly adjusted to live on the land due to the particular breeding mechanism that they had. Earth was extremely hot, another 5 or 6 degrees mean global temperature warmer than now. There was no ice, no ice caps. And when this entire habitat disappeared in a flash at 65 million years ago due to an impact by an asteroid, it was subsequently replaced by, not a cooler world, but a world which from about 55 million years ago started cooling. And at 34 million years ago, the end Eocene, there was a very sharp drop in temperature. And it's from the end Eocene that the ice sheets at Antarctica started to form. It's from the end Eocene 34 million years ago that mammals have started to flourish. with on the surface and get larger in size and numbers. Of course, that's not the end of the story, but if temperatures rise above the level, which is about 4 or 5 degrees higher than now, we will be trekking to an ice-free age, like the Earth which existed prior to 34 million years ago, prior to the Eocene. And that's where mammals, well, some mammals, many mammals, maybe most, will find it very hard to live at the surface due to the breeding mechanism, the extreme temperatures, and so on.
This is Green 960 AM, San Francisco. You're listening to the Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Glickson, the climate scientist from Australia. Let's get back to the ground in Australia. North American media are finally admitting that Australia may be on the front line of climate change, and it could be an example of what might hit the southern U.S. or the Mediterranean or many other parts of the world. Can you describe for us what it feels like to be in Australia these days and how people are reacting?
Well, it's not a very pretty picture, because it's only a few weeks ago, essentially in February, March, that the southern part in Victoria, essentially, temperature rose up to above 40 degrees, well above, with northwest winds. The bush was dry, tinderbox dry, and all it needed was a spark. That happened, and it was not a bushfire. These were firestorms. There's a difference. In a firestorm, the oxygen burns in the atmosphere above the bush, and there's no way of stopping it. The air temperatures rise to just everything gets incinerated in the path of these fireballs. Of course, it's not everywhere, but it's been described as explosions. It's been even described as, someone described it as a nuclear war, for God's sake. Anyway, that's what happened, and 170 people got burned, and I don't know how many hundreds got killed, and I don't know how many hundred got burned and in hospital. At the same time, and subsequently, major floods in the northeast, the northern New South Wales and Queensland. What happens is, and climate science has predicted it, as the energy level of the atmosphere is rising, the variability, weather variability, occurrence of extreme weather events also increases. And you can get out of extreme heat and dry, you can get extreme floods, and you can get cyclones, and that's been happening, I'm afraid, yes.
And what is the Australian government doing about this?
That's what everybody here is asking. They have a emission trading scheme presented to the parliament, which is so weak that it can't make a difference. It's certainly weaker than that which the European Union has been maintaining. It's 25% to 40% reduction of carbon emission by 2020. Relative to 1900. Here it's 5 to 15%. The whole point is reduction is not enough, because even if you reduce carbon dioxide emissions, so on, by whatever percent you reduce it with, 5, 15, 25, 40, even 60, I'd say, it still accumulates in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is cumulative. And therefore, we are now at 387 parts per million, and it can only rise, and there are the feedbacks, and this experiment has not been done before, Alex. It just has not been done before. Science can look at the trajectories and try and calculate the progress through computer modeling. It can look at the ice cores in the past and this event that I have described. But the rate at which things are changing now are faster than just about anything that we know in the recent history of the Earth. Like it's two orders of magnitude faster as far as carbon dioxide rise is concerned, and it's one order of magnitude faster as far as temperatures are concerned. So it's so fast that biological systems are finding it hard to adapt to, and that's a major worry.
It must be frustrating after so long studying the dynamics of the Earth to get real hard-won answers about this dangerous situation, and yet humans seem powerless to change. How do you personally manage to keep on going?
With great difficulty. I think every one of the scientists who are looking close at the actual evidence and the data and with perspective of past events is under stress and suffering in some way. In fact, there is also widespread denial among scientists in that not many are prepared to go ahead and express their concern in public. I have done that for 3 years now. I went and talked with parliamentarians more than 50 times here in the national capital. I convene conferences, write articles, give seminars. But it's a thankless job to be a messenger of such news.
And you have a mailing list where you mail out some of the articles and things that you write. Is that available to the public?
Oh, I have a list of colleagues and interested people that I send my articles to, quite apart from placing some of them on various electronic journals. And I've been publishing a journal called Crikey, which is quite widespread. I do what tiny, tiny little I can, but it's so hard to... You really want to encourage people. You really want to give them hope. You really want to be positive, and I try to do it, but at the same time, I'm also aware of evidence which is daunting, and I'm actually not sure how long I can continue to go on.
Maybe that is, you know, we have to keep going to explain the situation to the public, and perhaps there will be a wave of rapid recognition, we can only hope.
I'm somewhat encouraged by what Barack Obama is trying to do. My impression is that the man is trying to do the best in the circumstances. And he now has the best science advisors ever. I just don't know whether one man or one administration, one team can turn the wheel, turn the Titanic, so to speak, from colliding with an ice block. But I just pray.
Well, and Australia continues as a major coal exporter, so it's an irony of ironies that the major export product may be not killing off Australia, but certainly making it a more dangerous place.
Yeah, absolutely. Australia also has one of the highest per capita emission in the world. I think it's, whatever it is, 24, 25 tons carbon dioxide per person. It's tough. The thing is, because climate and climate science is complex, and you go outside into nature, into the world, and the blue skies and the birds are singing, and people think that you're insane as you say the sky is falling. Yeah. Intuitively, well, it's counterintuitive to talk about climate when people live in the weather. We don't live in the climate. We live in the weather, which changes. So when you talk about the climate, people say, oh, what are you looking at? Computer models? Are you looking at theoretical trends? What are you looking at? So we try and explain and say, well, look, levels of carbon dioxide and the migration of climate zones and the melting of the ice, in particular, most particularly the melting of the ice caps, which are, the thermostats of the Earth, as you know. I mean, that's where the cold air fronts emanate from. Without ice caps, life will change. It will be a greenhouse earth. It will not be the ice age. We live in an ice age, and we as mammals are adjusted and have grown up and are part of this ice age, which of course has glacials and interglacials. But anyway, it opened up an opportunity. This complexity of climate change opened up an opportunity for what's called, you know, the climate skeptics, so-called, deniers, the contrarians. They're not really skeptic because they already decided that the Earth is either not warming, or if it's warming, it's not warming due to human activities. So some of them are just naive. Many of them are just disinformed, misinformed. But there are also some which are, and we know it, and particularly in the United States and also here, who are supported and even funded by vested interests. They are extremely dangerous, even though there are not so many of them. Why? Because they sold out. It's like with the cigarette tobacco issue in the past. It's doubt we sell. And because people want good news rather than bad news, there is a huge temptation to believe them. A recent poll in the United States, I think, showed only one third of the people accept or understand that climate change is human-induced. And it's the same here. I have been arguing with these skeptics, but you can't argue with them because our minds are made up already. Don't confuse me with the facts, sort of thing.
I think eventually the message of science will get through. The big question is whether it will get through in time for us to take the actions that we need to save the atmosphere.
Indeed, time is the key word. I can't think of any other word. It's not as if we can argue with the physics and chemistry of the atmosphere. Economists think we could. I think you just put enough money behind it and you can just change, pull the levers down, cool the earth. Well, this brings me to geoengineering. I mean, that's another hope, at least in principle, which I think exists. Human ingenuity, technological ingenuity is such. Having split the atom, placed a man on the moon, God knows what else we've done, I don't think it's beyond humans to develop, and already ideas are already on the board. Develop carbon dioxide downdraw, so a drawdown technology. And I believe, I understand the Obama administration is actually looking at it because if they put enough funds behind it, and this comes back to where the funds come from, you will need to divert it from somewhere else, such as from the military. But if you did that, in order to truly defend, the next generation, let's say even our generation, then you need trillions to develop such, apply such technology around the world to downdraw carbon dioxide. But I see it now in terms of time, the time we have is possibly the one thing we can do because carbon emission reduction, I think, it's too late for. You can reduce emissions, but because of the long residence time of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on the scale of hundreds of years and more, it just will keep on accumulating and kicking up feedbacks.
You've heard it here. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Dr. Andrew Glickson, a world-recognized scientific expert from Australia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Well, thank you for everything you're doing.
This week's music theme from Ellis Music Productions, our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Adios, muchachos.
It's a fragile world in dire need, cause where we gonna go? Well, I don't know. Spending money, finding life on Mars doesn't make any sense to me. Trying to live at the bottom of the ocean, some things are not meant to be. What I want to know is where we're going to go. When the oceans rise and the strong winds blow, and the temperature melts the ice and snow. But time to wait won't be long and it'll be too late. Together and we're all at stake, cause where we gonna go, I don't know.